May it please the court. This is a reciprocal discipline case from Federal District.
Speak up just a little bit.
I'm sorry. Thank you. This is a reciprocal discipline case from the Federal District Court for the Western District of Missouri. The federal court's discipline case was itself premised on facts already found by bankruptcy court. Following a contested hearing where the bankruptcy court sanctioned this respondent for three violations of their procedural rules, requiring him to disgorge his fee and pay triple his fee as a fine. The bankruptcy court found that while representing a debtor, respondent did these three things. First, after initially warning his client against preferential loan repayments to her mother, respondent told her, saying this in an email, "Short of it not happening, my next best advice is to make sure it cannot be traced and stick with the story, it did not happen." And the court made a finding that he, in fact, intended to mislead the court. Second, the court found that respondent knew, or at least should have known, that the debtor had horses but failed to list them as assets, and that he, quote, condoned the practice of minimizing reporting assets, finding specifically that it is more credible that respondent knew the debtor still owned horses and failed to list them. And third, that he failed to, that he filed pleadings, amended pleadings, without getting the client debtor's signature. Those facts found by the bankruptcy court were expressly adopted by the federal district court.
Can you explain? I know at some point his partner or someone else did some of the filings, or if I'm remembering right. Did everything he do personally, or did someone else appear for him one day in the court?
Not a partner, but a friend who he said, "Can you show up at the 341 hearing?"
And were any of these things done? Could any of these, the second or third incidents, be attributed to miscommunication between the two of them in the filing, or were these things that personally Mr. Bisges was involved in?
The court found no. The court found that he is the one that did those things that I just described. I mean, that's what the findings are. That there's evidence that the other attorney was there at one of the hearings, and that he may have heard something that might have supported a justification or a defense. But the findings that I think are final are those that I just described.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, was there any mitigating factors to why he would send an email to his client to deceive the court? Any drugs, personal tragedy, anything that would cause him to do that?
I don't think there's anything that's part of the record along that. I mean, factually, the history of it, you know, is part of it. I mean, the fact that the client told him, he asked the client for, you know, "Tell me what all your assets are," and those sorts of things. You know, he had a checklist, like I assume a lot of bankruptcy attorneys have, and his staff tried to meet with them and find out what she had. And then he sent an email to her saying, you know, "Tell me what else is going on." She wrote back saying, "Well, I had to pay a bank $5,000, and so I borrowed that money from my mom. I made out a check to her for $3,000 to pay her back." So he says, "That's a bad idea." He said, "They get ugly on paying family members back. Can you imagine that the trustee will look at it?" You know, in other words, he's giving her advice that he should be giving her at that time, saying, "That's a problem. You can't pay family members back to the detriment of secured creditors or other creditors." She writes back, so the history of it may matter a little bit, if that's what your question is going. Saying, "Well, I can't pay her back because I borrowed the money knowing I'd be getting back my tax refund. And I knew I'd be getting a tax return back and didn't want to hold up the liens on the house. Doesn't that work?" He said, "Well, you might think so, but repaying a family member back is a preference, and they have to collect it from mom. So that's, in his next sentence after that is where he says, short of that not happening, my next best advice is to make sure it cannot be traced and stick with the story, it did not happen. So there is, you know, how he came to do it isn't the same as some lawyers who come in and say, you got to lie about this, you know, who just lead off with, you're going to have to do this, you need to make up a story, the only way we're going to win is to do that. He was put in a position by his client. He started out giving proper advice and then didn't and gave really bad advice. That's why we're here. Once we get to this point where those findings, and I think they should be considered final findings, the court still has two tasks. First is, do these facts prove any violations of our Rule 4? And because the court does make its own determination as to that, even in reciprocal discipline cases. And second, if the court does find violations, then have to determine what a sanction is. Again, even though the federal court entered a sanction, it's up to this court, and probably unique to this court, to determine fitness for practice in the whole state. So this court makes its own analysis on those. As to violations, I think that's a pretty easy question. In fact, respondent acknowledges that his emails were improper. And because the court found that he did, in fact, intend to mislead the court, I think that's a pretty clear violation of Rule 8.4C and Rule 3.3. 8.4C just talks about dishonesty and misrepresentation generally. 3.3 talks more about knowingly making a false statement or failing to correct a false statement to the court or knowingly offering false evidence. As it turned out, that evidence did not get offered. I'm sorry?
Discipline you recommend is suspension. And how do you come to that recommendation?
Well, let's back up a little bit. Actually, in our brief and in our initial petition, we asked for recommended a reprimand. We acknowledged, though, that knowing that, and that's what, you know, based in part on what that's what the court, the federal court did. We also said that reprimand is in line with a range of sanctions, including a suspension. We referred to a 1992 case, Verdutt, having similar facts resulting in a six-month suspension. And we wrote that if respondents fail to check the box and give that advice are deemed to be the equivalent of offering evidence known to be false, then more than a reprimand is appropriate.
What about the mitigating evidence in this case? What did you find what was found as mitigation?
I think just one thing, frankly, but it may be an important one, and that is I think the remorse appears to be sincere. I mean, you read it back in his letter to the federal district court when he was being disciplined, and then to this court, the brief and the responses to this court appear to show sincere remorse.
Cooperation
with us has been fine. The thing that I think is not mitigating that he argues in the brief is that his production of the emails that occurred after the bankruptcy was over, and they were brought back because there was a potential conflict, and the trustee brought them back in and asked for all the attorney records. And then he produced them, you know, at the trustee's request. So I think I don't think he gets credit for doing what he was going to be required to do. The trustee said turn over the records. He turned them over. His actually response to us indicates that that's when he realized, after turning them over, that the emails were in there. And in any event, I don't think he gets extra credit for doing something that if he hadn't done, he'd be subject to discipline for.
Now, he'd been admonished a couple of times before.
You're right. In 1997 for diligence and failure to supervise, almost 20 years ago now, and in 2007 for failure to return a fee that, you know, once wasn't fully earned. And then another aggravating circumstance would be the dishonesty itself can be considered an aggravating circumstance.
But they were 10 years apart.
10 years apart and 10 years since the last, or 9 years since the last one as well.
And so OCDC today is asking for a reprimand, but would also be comfortable with a 6-month suspension, is that, or?
I can word that either way. Yes, we would be comfortable with anything within that range, that's right. I think, there are a couple of cases, 1990 Wallingford case, I think it's in our brief, and the first couple's case, 1997, really were dishonesty cases that ended up with reprimands.
Is probation appropriate in dishonesty cases, or more appropriate when there's like drugs or other kinds of problems?
Right. I think that's a fair question. We usually think that probation is better suited for rehabilitation, whether it's law practice management skill improvement or whatever. I mean, recovery from some condition, and dishonesty, it doesn't seem to fit well. You know, I know that it seems sometimes that we, all of us, kind of think of it as an interim sanction between reprimand and suspension as well. You know, I think that's a good question, though. Is it appropriate in cases where there's dishonesty? And we would usually say it doesn't. It's not intended to accomplish that. So the Verdutt case that I talked about, Donahoe in 1990, diligence violation aggravated by his deliberate misrepresentation to the disciplinary system, also resulted in a brief suspension. I can't remember whether it's 6 months or a year. And so there are some cases where suspension is appropriate. That's more common. The ABA sanction standards are a little hard to work through, but on these points. But I think that a suspension is probably most fitting when you apply the ABA standards, and I'll talk about that in.
Do we have any further information about why the federal court chose to impose a censure instead of a suspension?
I don't see anything in there. There's not an analysis of how they got there that I found.
Thank you.
Do you have what's your process in determining what kind of sanctions to be imposed?
Yeah, thinking about it from a reciprocal discipline standing, which is what we have, we start with what the other court did. I mean, it seems to be a reasonable baseline, especially when the behavior was not just public behavior, but was behavior that directly impacted was actions that were going on in that court. So that's a starting point. Then we try to look at what this court has done in the past, and we try to apply the ABA sanction standards.
Thank you.
So that's the process.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Matt Keeler for respondent, Noel Biscus. This is my first time before the court, so I apologize if I'm a little shaky or nervous. I'd like to begin, if I can indulge the court's patience, by asking you to picture a December weekend night at busy shopping mall. You're carrying packages to your car. You open the door, you lose grip, and you hit the car next to you. I think all of us would agree that an honest person, and what the informant's been talking about, is Mr. Biscus's honesty. That's what this email calls into question. An honest person gets out a piece of paper, writes a note, sticks it under the windshield. Especially in a busy December weekend night and it's dark, you're cloaked with anonymity. If you just get in your car and drive away, we've all probably had in our lifetimes where you're washing your car and all of a sudden you see something, somebody's hit you, and you think to yourself, I never got a note under my windshield wiper. We're here today. I know they discount what Mr. Biscus did after the dispute between his former client and her ex-husband arose, and they started accusing each other of hiding assets, which is when the U.S. trustee, I represented him in that bankruptcy case and throughout, so I'm intimately familiar with the facts. That's when they subpoenaed or they asked for his entire file. They got a waiver of the attorney-client privilege so they could get the entire file from the adversary. He turned it over. We're here today because he broke the note and put it under the windshield wipers. If he really believed and did what he practiced and what he said in that improper email,
no,
which
we're here today because he, in an email, told his client to deceive the court. I mean, that's a that's why we're here. It's not a note under the windshield.
But Your Honor, he's the only one who had the email. The former client, the opposing party, did not get the email from the opposing, from his former client. It came from his file. He didn't review his file and purge it or destroy paper like it's referenced.
But he sent the email. Didn't he send the email to his client?
He did. He did. He testified. Well, he was frustrated. It's in the district, the bankruptcy court's order. The bankruptcy court acknowledged and informed it.
So it's not a random note he wrote to himself and said, gee, maybe I'll send this email or not.
No.
He sent the email to his client.
You're addressing Mr. Phillips' statement that that wasn't at all mitigating, that he turned it over, and it doesn't negate his wrong, but you're saying he, when he saw that, he turned it over, so you want the court to consider that.
Well, it was the discovery request is proper, and he complied with it. He didn't try to subterfuge and get around the rules. In contrast to, they mentioned the...
But if he tried to get around the rule, that'd be obstruction, that's even more problematic. He's following what he's supposed to do.
I agree, Your Honor. Two wrongs don't make a right. But my point is, if he practiced what he preached, I don't know that we would really be here. And I'm not saying that that's correct, but the In re Vandergrift
case. Are you saying that's relevant to whether this was a unique circumstance or whether he makes a pattern of dishonesty and that he was dishonest? You agree on that one occasion, but he chose not to be because it's not normal for him.
It goes to, I think, Your Honor, his character. In that In re Vandergrift case that they mentioned, that attorney counseled his client to mislead the tribunal. It was an ALJ, I believe. And then they actually caught him through an investigation, and the client called on a sting. If you read the case, the federal officials were eavesdropping with permission, and the former client called and talked to the lawyer. It was kind of a sting operation. That's not what we have here. Mr. Biscus turned over his file pursuant to the request. The email was in there. This is
pursuant to a lawful request.
What?
Pursuant
to a lawful request.
Right.
And that's my point, is he follows the rules. I think you can
right.
look at that
Right, which he should have done, right.
So why didn't he on the one occasion that's at issue here?
With the email? Mm-hmm. His testimony was he was frustrated. He kept giving the client advice and she kept challenging it. It's not an excuse, but an explanation. We see it all the time, I think, when we're reading the newspapers that people tweet or email things that they regret in haste. He started off, as they said, started off with the right advice. It's not like he said, come in and hide things. And we attached in our appendix his what I call the information sheet, which people, you know, they provide information during the initial bankruptcy consultation. It's detailed. There's all kinds of chicken scratch and everything because his practice was that he would do the right thing. In fact, as to this question about they touched on, there was a heavy discovery dispute with the former client about whether she told him about horses. And even on that page, there's a mark that says animals, and there's a slash indicating
let me ask you the
answer was no. So there was a discovery dispute that the bankruptcy judge did not find in his favor, I believe, partly because of the email. His credibility was shot.
Let me ask you this. There's a trend in discipline nowadays to think about if this person were to apply to the bar with this record, would you admit them? Would you, if you saw this record of dealing with other people before the person applied to the bar, would you admit this person to the bar?
I have a difficult position because I have more context. If all you looked at was the email, it would be very difficult. If you said, I'm just going to look at this email and that's it, I'm ignoring everything else. But I think knowing the context, and that's one of the reasons why I put like the information sheet he takes from his clients and the point to the fact that it was a proper discovery request and he's not, you're right, two wrongs don't make a right. But he did do the right things. He did show that he did do the right things. There was a whole dispute in the bankruptcy court. He was accused of violating this court's rules about conflict of interest and having another lawyer help and appear at a 341 meeting when he was out of town. And the bankruptcy judge said, no, you did everything right in those cases. There wasn't a conflict at first, and then when a conflict arose, you got out. So I think, Your Honor, there's more context that I'm aware of that I would say, I think he's a good lawyer. I think he made a mistake, and he's apologized for it. He's been very sincere. He's had to sit through CLEs in which his bankruptcy case was talked about while he was in the room. You know, they're talking about him. There's been court cases. There's been appeals. There's now going to be this case. He's been publicly disciplined. And I think, for me, part of the question, and I don't know if it's improper, and I apologize if it's not, but we're talking about mitigation and whether
there are different kinds of infractions. If it's getting papers in late or there are some personal problems, that's one thing, but purposely deceiving a court, misleading a court, that's an entirely different infraction from I got the papers in late, I'm sorry.
The statement was improper. The bankruptcy judge acknowledged that he testified that he thought that she was talking about a future payment, and she used the word borrow in the email. She put it in quotes. He thought it meant because it was a gift. Otherwise, there's no reason to put a normal word borrow in quotes. He thought that Mr. Business testified. He thought his client meant it was the opposite. It was a gift. She wanted to repay, but still make a preference. U.S. trustee, whether it's a debt or a gift, if you're taking money and giving it to a relative, they're going to be able to get it back. But what I was going to suggest is, again, I apologize if it's an improper. I think a message to send to Mr. Biscus, but also to all the lawyers in the state, is, you know, with turning over the file, if you make a mistake, don't compound it by keeping doing bad. Do what's right. Follow the rules. And the court may take that into consideration as part of mitigation and part of showing that you have good character versus having to get caught, like in Vanderhoff, through a sting. I apologize.
Been focusing on the effect on Mr. Biscus, but our rules of ethical requirements and the punishments that are imposed are not to punish the attorney, but to protect the public. And so what kind of precedence would we be establishing by saying that an attorney can affirmatively tell their client to lie and put that client in peril with the court? How are we protecting the public?
The protection of the public, I would begin by saying, I believe the district court took that into consideration, and I think that's part of what they came up with. Their public reprimand was to publicly discipline and scold him. I think they looked at the context of the whole case and some of these items that we've talked about in mitigation and realized that the one email was not a reflection of a lawyer that used the head of the court for the whole state, fear that you can't trust this guy. You can't trust him to be, whether it's in a federal court or in Cole County Court, wherever. You know, I think that there's additional information that the court could say he made a mistake and the punishment's appropriate, but we don't have to suspend him or disbar him. The initial recommendation was public reprimand from the informant. Mr. Biscus agreed with that. I also argued in our brief that if a greater sentence was to be imposed, that perhaps it could be subject to probation, and if he successfully completed probation, then, for example, suspension would be stayed or lifted. But I believe that there's more context than just the one email to indicate that he's a threat. You know, and that's, to me, that's the point of
Are any other collateral consequences that occur from a public reprimand? Does he get higher insurance costs, or does he have what repercussions occur from a public reprimand?
Well, I could tell you, I think that for one, it like I said, it's humiliating. It's going to hurt his practice. I can't speak.
That's only if you read the Missouri. That's only if you read the Missouri Bar Journal. I mean,
correct.
Most people don't read the Missouri Bar Journal.
Well, I hope most lawyers do, but
lawyers may not.
I can tell the court that I know from experience, because I was hired by his malpractice care, they didn't renew him. Because of this type of mistake. I don't know that he can't get insurance from someone else, and I don't know exactly how much that would apply to any type of mitigation factors. But
what about the damage to the profession for failure to suspend somebody, in addition to violates the canons, violates the oath that he took, not not lie to the court. I mean, we're going to swear in 800 and some lawyers here on Friday who are going to take that oath, and we're going to assume they're going to tell the truth. What kind of message are we sending to them if we don't suspend him?
I respectfully suggest, Your Honor, that each case is a fingerprint. It's unique. And I think for this situation, the court can look at the facts and say, there are items that would merit suspension, but then there's also mitigation. There's other evidence and there's other factors that would show that he did have good character. He did do the right thing, which gives the court the ability to say, we're not going to just say that everybody's cookie cutter. You get charged with a certain thing and this is what's going to happen. We are going to look at the ABA standards and the mitigation factors, as well as there's aggravating factors that the court's asked to look at sometimes as well. But that you look at each case on an individual basis. I think what all those 800 lawyers would want is, if they had made a mistake, that hopefully they get, I'm not suggesting this court's not going to give Mr. Biscus a fresh would get unique look and see if there was a mitigation circumstance to warrant not having suspension.
Practice of law is a privilege, not a right.
Absolutely.
And we're not putting him in jail. We're looking at the privilege of practicing law and dealing with the public with our imprimatur. When we admit the people to the bar, the public has a right to think those folks are honest, law-abiding, not just law-abiding, honest people who treat you fairly and not lie to you or urge you to violate the law. That's what the public has a right to expect when we admit people to the bar. That's what we do as the Supreme Court. And that's sort of a trust between the public and us.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's where I go back. I feel repetitive, and I apologize for it.
No,
I think it's very important that he did do the right thing. The court can question and say, is this a guy, a bad person, a bad apple we can't trust? We need to punish and suspend him to send a message to the rest of the bar. I think the court could look at it and say, actually, there's a bad email that he turned over. He's the one that disclosed it and made it to the whole world. It didn't come from anywhere else. He put the note under the windshield because he does have honesty. And the court can say, if you make a mistake.
So you think we could vouch, like Diogenes, we could vouch that this is an honest person that the public could trust and go to as a lawyer?
Yes, I think that's what the district court did, Your Honor. I think they looked at this and they said, we can publicly discipline him. He needs, there's disciplines appropriate, but they didn't take away his license and say he can't be a bankruptcy lawyer. They let him continue on. I firmly believe it's partly because, as his informant's counsel mentioned, his remorse. If you read, I made sure, I said, you write a letter that's not doctored by me or by someone else. You write it from your heart, from your soul. And that's what he did. I believe they read that, and I believe they looked at some of these other things and realized that the one incident, that one fateful moment, and I'm not excusing it, and he's never asked for it to be excused or forgotten, but that's not the true picture of what he is and what his character is and what his honesty is. See my time is up. I apologize for going over.
Any other questions?
Yeah, well, I'd like to say this is a very good first time in the court. Well, these are very difficult cases. I look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Mr. Phillips.
Thank you. The three things that I hope to try to cover in the last 3 minutes.
If the district court didn't discipline him any further, why should we?
Again, the court has a different perspective than the federal district court does, and that is that it's not just about whether that person is eligible to practice there. It's about this court has the responsibility to protect the public generally.
Well, what Judge Finner said is, having fully considered the matter before us, particularly that Mr. Biscus acknowledges the wrongfulness of his conduct and that he has not been previously disciplined for professional misconduct, the undersigned recommend a public censure be issued. So they, after listening to that, determined public censure would be adequate.
Right.
Well, he said no further discipline. What did he mean by that? Was the judge who entered the censure aware of the prior discipline?
We don't oppose.
The prior admonitions?
That's the difference. Right?
Well, it's a difference, right. I think it's a whole different perspective.
Admonitions are not disciplined by this court. Admonitions are not disciplined by this court. They're agreed to. Is that right?
They are consensual. That's true. And right, and not issued by the court.
Did the district court have the prior discipline before them?
That's a good question. Not that I know of. I mean, I think we would have had a request for them. I don't think we usually get those requests, frankly.
But that would have been up to the district court.
I mean, because more often than not, they're following this court instead of the other way around. I mean, the bankruptcy court is sometimes more active with their own lawyers and goes ahead and does discipline. But, you know, most of the misconduct that occurs, whether it occurs in federal court or otherwise, comes here first, and they do they are more often the reciprocal court.
Would you compare the conduct in this case to the conduct in Kriegel, which I think came out in the midst of this?
Kriegel was the adoption case.
Right. No, I remember the case. I was trying to think about it. I was thinking more about the Disney case in 1986, where he hid some assets from his ex-wife who had a judgment against him. That was a suspension case. And the Verdet case, where he deceived his client, I mean, deceived the court by asking questions that he was hoping to elicit an answer that about two past husbands, and in fact she had three, and that ended up not being material, but he thought it was at the time. I'm struggling with applying Kriegel to it, Your Honor. I apologize for that.
Well, Kriegel was when he misled the court allowed his counsel to mislead the court by presenting evidence that was contrary to what the facts were. So it does have the intentionally misleading the tribunal, but somewhat similar in that the client did it more than he did. Here the client didn't go forward and do it. So
right. I mean, I think those and the Donahoe case, 1990 reported decision also, and even Dade, an unreported decision from 2 years ago. Those are all suspension cases. I think they would be good guidance, as well as ABA sanction standards 6.12 and 6.22. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.